Lockhart, Texas. I'm your host, Noah Williams.
And I'm your co-host, Connor Stewart.
For episode 160 of The Second Echelon.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we're getting up there. We are getting up there. But it's a pleasure, and we have always many new things to talk about. Sometimes we have to sit down and deliberate a little bit what topic is of interest, a little more so than in the first 80 episodes, say. But we're getting there, and it's a lot of fun. And today, not necessarily. It is good timing for this topic, but that wasn't the intent or by design or anything like that.
It just happens to be.
Absolutely. It's on the board. We've been meaning to bring it to you guys for a little while. And so today, in the context of cycling, right, and many of these things are applicable outside of cycling as well, but in the context of cycling today, we're going to be talking about weight loss, how to do it intentionally, how to set the right targets and goals for yourself, the mindset around weight loss, how we do it with our clients, so on and so forth. So without any further ado, like I just mentioned, the first thing I kind of wanted to touch on was the mindset around weight loss, particularly in cycling. There are numerous cyclists with eating disorders or really poor eating and nutritional habits. And you'd be surprised to learn that I don't necessarily have any data to back this up offhand, although I think I've seen some statistic about it in the past. But there are actually a fair number of cyclists, even elite level cyclists, who are really metabolically unwell. And that can happen. You know, you think, well, they're doing all this training and their metabolism's revved up all the time. And yeah, so in a sense, it's better than being completely stagnant. But just like a high-performance car, if you run it at full throttle all the time, there's actually a lot of extra work that you have to do to keep it running and make sure that it's doing everything optimally. And the same goes for really all aerobic endurance athletes.
And if you're not going to give your body enough nutrition or enough sleep, enough rest, and you keep it running hot consistently, constantly, it's going to just throttle you back on its own, right? Instead of letting you just run it max at full capacity, it's going to let you run at max at 70% capacity.
Right. You'll still be able to go as hard as you want, but your output will steadily drop and drop and drop. And this is really the primary reason for that is athletes are not recovering well enough or not recovering enough overall. So quantity or quality of rest, either way there, whether it's, you know, your training plan literally doesn't have enough rest programmed into it, which is not as common, or it's something like your sleep is really poor or your nutrition is really poor, and so your body's not able to fully rebound in a normal amount of time, even if you do have enough quote-unquote recovery days scheduled. Right. If you're not sleeping fully, if you're not, you know, nourishing yourself, it's not just about calories. It's about the nutritional content of the food you're eating as well. It's something we're going to talk about more deeply later in the episode. But fundamentally, a big part of being at the ideal weight, the healthy weight, your race weight, whatever that may be for you, is it involves being metabolically healthy. Mm-hmm. Because what we really want to do in order to achieve a sustainable, optimized weight, we have to do it very slowly. It has to be a very natural state for your body to be in. All of its needs have to be met. And so fundamentally, this is, you can think of this as the opposite of a diet, right?
Right. And I was going to say, it's very easy to get in these mindsets of, crash diet, lose the weight quickly. You know, it feels good to have the weight pour off of you when you're overweight and fighting towards looking at a quote unquote better you health wise. But when you do it quickly, you're putting your body in emergent states. And yeah, sure, you lose weight quickly, but ultimately it's not good for your metabolism. It's not good for your heart organs. It's not good for your bones, really any of your body systems. It's going to take a toll. And then when you start to come back out of it, you have an initiated lifestyle change. So odds are you're going to go back to whatever habits you were doing before. And those emergent body states change you metabolically permanently. So you're going to enter some sort of state where instead of your carbs turning into glycogen, getting stored in the muscle. Every time I say glycogen now, I think of that one guy going off on a podcast about some guy. When I look over at you, you better be wearing a lab coat.
It was Chris D'Elia and Brian Callen. Great clip.
So you're going to pretty much permanently change your body's metabolic states when you start to intake carbohydrates. Instead of storing it as it should, it's going to go straight to fat. And you're gonna balloon back up, and that doesn't feel good. I mean, we see that a lot.
Super common. I know a lot of cyclists who engage, over time. Not like personally right now, they're doing bad things. You know what I mean? But over time, been in the sport long enough to see people gain weight, lose weight, people manage weight well, people who go up and down on a roller coaster, and ultimately, your mindset around this is that if you should be something along the lines of that if you clean your diet up and remove all the junk from it, and by all, I really mean more approaching like an 80-20 kind of lifestyle. We'll talk more about 80-20 later, but fundamentally, I think you can imagine 80% of the foods you're eating are clean, free of ultra processed foods and additives and preservatives, minimizing or eliminating things like hydrogenated vegetable oils altogether. And
seed oils,
focusing on getting in whole foods. So 80% whole foods, and then 20% of your diet can be junk basically, or whatever else. And ultimately we kind of need that 20%. It's generally, I've seen athletes who've gone 100% clean. I've gone 100% clean for periods of time before. And it's really, really tricky when you get into situations where you have to be adaptable and high performance at the same time. And that is anytime you travel anywhere for a bike race.
Right.
You have to be adaptable. And moreover, it's really difficult to eat sweet potatoes during a race.
Yes, it is.
you cannot, as an endurance athlete, you're, especially in today's day and age, it's really difficult to avoid some processed foods altogether.
Yep.
Right.
And be it for your the happenings of your life or the happenings of traveling for an event, like you were saying. And really, if you are eating perfectly clean, 100% clean, and you're forced to switch in some sort of situation, the things that happen to your gut and the stomach aches you're gonna experience and the noises and the gas, just general discomfort, pain, all that jazz. It's going to ruin the next few days for you.
Yes.
And if this is a event we're talking about, especially, like, that sucks. Like, you ate so clean, coming into it, behaved so well, only to have just the need to eat ruin the experience for you. Like,
pretty brutal. And I've had it happen to me before. And, in an ideal world, that's what we'd like to see everybody avoid. And so underneath this 80-20, digging into it a little bit more for the time being, is there's a spectrum of performance and there's a spectrum between optimization and adaptability. Mm. And on one hand, if you eat junk all the time, aside from having probably chronic and acute inflammation, you're highly adaptable. Nothing bothers you.
Right.
You can eat whatever the heck is available. Let's go get breakfast at QT.
Yeah, because if you eat Waffle House for breakfast every day and you your teammates cook up some scrambled egg whole food for you, that's not going to bother you.
You'll
be fine.
Right. But if all you eat is scrambled eggs, rice, and steak, and broccoli, and that's it.
Someone gives you a...
And then you have to go to
Aunt Jemima Whataburger. Covered waffle.
Right.
The water chicken.
Yeah, you're stuck with a hotel breakfast.
Yeah. You were gonna
it's gonna be a really bad time on your gut.
Excuse my French, you were gonna shit yourself.
you very well might. But if you go too far in the optimization end and you eat super, super clean for an extended period of time, you will lose your ability to adapt. And we want to maintain some ability to adapt, primarily for the reason of it's difficult to eat purely clean on the bike. So there's a performance advantage and incentive to being adaptable to a small amount. Think along the lines of gels and blocks and Clif Bars. If you literally just eat steak and rice and eggs and fish and vegetables, those things, gels, bars, and blocks, will probably tear you up pretty good. Probably. It's probably not going to be the worst thing that you could eat. You know, anything that's from a restaurant or, you know, fast food or an ultra processed, you know, Pop-Tarts or Oreos or something along those lines will probably jack you up very, very badly. And that's not to say that it's not good to eat that way. It's very healthy to eat that way. But in the context of cycling specifically and aerobic endurance sports more broadly.
Performance generally.
Generally. Yeah. You want to maintain some adaptability, some ability to readily eat small amounts of junk for high levels of performance at the time, because the ultra processed foods and processed foods like bars, gels, and blocks, right? And we've literally also discussed alternative ride foods like oatmeal cream pies, Pop-Tarts, Uncrustables. These are horrendous foods. they lack nutritional value.
Calling them foods is actually a bit of a misnomer.
I don't know what else to call it.
Right, it's stuff that I put in my mouth and chew and swallow.
Yeah,
probably food.
And then I burn it. But point is you want to maintain some level of adaptability. And for on the bike nutrition as well as for travel nutrition, especially if you're traveling, you know, outside of your home environment. Heck, even going to another state. Right. Grocery stores are different. Some of the restaurants can be different, you know, and a lot of times bike races are in remote areas where your options are limited. And what are available are your Pizza Hut and your McDonald's
and
whatever you can get at the grocery store, which believe me, I'd rather you just cook for every meal. But like we talked about in Race Ready and in Stage Racing 101, you don't necessarily have the time to cook for yourself. Maybe you're staying in a hotel room or a small Airbnb where there's no kitchen, or you just have a single burner or a microwave, something along those lines. Like, you're not necessarily going to be able to go pick up steaks at the grocery store and then throw them on the grill in your hotel room.
Right.
That's not, you know, so your options are really limited, and this is where you want to be super adaptable. And then on top of all of that, there's just the regular balance of day-to-day life, right? Like, we have holidays, we have special occasions. You should be, you know, going on dates with your significant other.
Run out of time sometimes too. It's just life.
Well, and you know, have a treat with your kids once in a while, right, or whatever it is. Like sometimes after a big test, you want a slice of pizza and a bowl of ice cream. Freaking go for it, man. You earned it. You know, there's room for balance. Yeah. And I think if you try to stick super, super monk-like, healthy, clean all the time, there's some people that can do it with relatively low stress.
And they can switch on and off of it fine.
Sure. But that's not most people.
Be grateful you have a blessed gut.
right. And so we want to strive for some kind of balance. And the reason we want to strive for balance is because this needs to be sustainable over long periods of time. This isn't something that we can impact aggressively and directly in a very short period of time.
Without consequence
or in the form of compromise to your training and racing performance. And so it needs to be very gradual in the context of training and racing. Even during the off season, we want it to be gradual. And as well, we want it to be gradual because we want, when we arrive at where we're trying to go, we want the landing and the transition into a maintenance phase to be very, very seamless. Mm. And the reality is it should. I mean, I subscribe to the idea that if you just eat the nutrition and the amount of calories that your body needs at a fundamental healthy level and allow your body to steadily transition in that direction, you actually don't even need to make any major adjustments.
No.
Once you've arrived at your goal weight.
Yeah.
You've just said, this is the amount of nutrition and fuel that we need. We've got extra right now. You're going to just use it and we're going to get there. And ultimately what this amounts to for a lot of people, you can, for most people listening to this, that are currently racing, you probably, if you want to lose weight, if you've clicked on this podcast for that reason, the reality is you're likely to want to lose somewhere between 10 and 25 pounds.
Yeah.
If you want to lose more than that, then that's more of a situation where we can look at taking more drastic measures to get you under that 25-pound window.
It's going to take some time if you're looking to lose more than 25, for sure. Most people are carrying around about 10 extra pounds, though.
Most people are carrying around about 10 extra pounds. And if you're... Also, hear me on this. If you're somebody who wants to lose or can lose more than 25 pounds, the reality is that your first 5, 10, 15 pounds can come off very, very quickly. Mm. Without you being starving, without you being nutritionally deficient, but it will still limit your ability to do high-intensity, prolonged exercise.
Mm, definitely.
And so that's kind of a strategic compromise that you maybe want to make, and maybe we supplement with some metabolism boosting low intensity rides while fasted, and maybe we're doing some light two-a-days where we're arrive in the morning and a walk in the evening. Like, these types of things can be accomplished even in the context of cycling coaching, like what we do.
Definitely.
I've had to do it before, and so it's not foreign territory to us. But if you want to lose more than 25 pounds, you want to maybe mentally wrap your head around a focused 2 to 4 week period where that is what we want to attack first and foremost.
Yeah.
And once you kind of get in that 20 pounds to go range, or maybe you're already under 20 pounds, maybe you only want to lose 5 or 10 or 15. Okay. You don't really have to stop training at all for that. That's just about tweaking things nutritionally and making sure that you're resting and all that kind of stuff.
The Second Echelon is a Williams Racing Academy production. WRA, world-class coaching and training for cyclists since 1999. WRA represents a passionate community and expert staff that are totally focused on setting you up for success on and off the bike, no matter how big or how small your goals are. Three main things set WRA apart from the rest. First is our service model. With Christian at the helm of all WRA training, regardless of your primary coach or service level, the same attention to detail goes into each and every plan. Every WRA training plan is 100% custom and just as unique as the athlete it's built for. Second, all of our coaches are full-time and work as a team with Christian, keeping them flexible and available for communication. Finally, WRA is the sole operator of Belgium Racing Experience. Since starting the program in 2011, our understanding of elite development and the ability to guide athletes into the professional ranks is unparalleled in the United States. Nutrition coaching and off-the-bike strength training are included, and we offer professional bike fitting and one-on-one skills training. All this at extremely competitive pricing, starting at $219 a month through the end of 2022. Lock in your rate before the end of the year and start manifesting your inner apex predator today. Head over to WRA1999.com and check out our services and FAQ page for more information. That's WRA1999.com. Promo code APEX lets us know you know what's up and takes $50 off your first invoice with no commitment. That's code APEX for $50 off your first invoice with no commitment. We look forward to having you in the WRA family. The Second Echelon is presented by Jackru. Jackru has over 20 years of experience manufacturing custom cycling, triathlon, running, and Nordic apparel. Jackru offers free design, no minimums, and fast delivery. Designers and staff are here in the States and will help you bring your design ideas to life for free. Check out the WRA Jackru clothing store at WRA1999.com. We've got hoodies, vests, base layers, long sleeve jerseys, rain jerseys, neck gaiters, and more available now. Or start designing your kit and accessories online today at Jackru.com. We were Jackru clients for years before we became partners. The quality, value, speed, and customer service are totally unmatched in the cycling clothing industry. We couldn't be more proud to be in the Jackru family, and we are hugely grateful for their support of the Second Echelon, Williams Racing Academy, and Belgium Racing Experience. Thank you, Jackru.
For the folks that are in that 25, 20 pounds or less, you want to be looking at losing about a pound a week, roughly speaking.
So we have BMI variation here. We're specifically talking about losing 10 pounds of excess fat, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Do we ever, and is this something, not something classically that people approach, but losing pounds of muscle? It's a hard conversation because you don't want to take it away from, the core of the leg area, but, there are definitely lots of people that will come into this and they're jacked.
Sure.
Right? That are looking I'm just thinking of some bodybuilding friends of mine that got into cycling.
Oh yeah.
Looking to lose just muscle, straight up muscle mass.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sort of different conversation.
Yes.
So for the context of the conversation, we're talking about excess fat.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. At the same time, I would argue there's nothing really acute or aggressive you would do specifically to lose muscle. Again, that's going to come back to the piece of how many pounds do you want to weigh? Let's say you weigh 190 right now and okay. You're kind of stacked and you think 175 is possible. Mm. We're on board. Not a lot of fat there, but we got a lot of, maybe we were triathlon focused before, or maybe we were deep into CrossFit or something like that. Mm. And we're making a transition. Not uncommon, less common
for sure.
Folks who just want to lean up for performance reasons and aren't necessarily, maybe I think the majority of people who just want to lean up also would probably like to put on a little bit of upper body mass
typically, for
aesthetic purposes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we absolutely do address that with Apex Protocol and our kettlebell complex and the plank and stuff like that. Because, I don't think having an underdeveloped upper body is good for athletic performance or self-confidence or general preparedness or longevity in general.
Yeah.
So it's not like we want to turn anybody into a twig.
No.
But in the same way,
you also don't want to be, looking like The Rock.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's hard to do on accident.
Yeah.
I don't know much.
It takes probably shitloads of intention.
Maybe like a few $100,000.
I don't know.
But the point is that, if you're looking to lose muscle, you want to underfeed on protein, but you don't want to do anything drastic. Coming back to the concept of feed yourself at what is going to nourish you optimally at your optimal weight.
Right. So, and that means if you're weighing 190 and you've got, let's say, 25 pounds of excess body fat, you're going to be eating for a 165 pound person. If
correct.
That's your goal weight.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we mean. So when you're calculating BMR, with basal metabolic rate, you're calculating, it's just your different, caloric expenditures. Calculate for someone at 165 if that's your healthy weight.
Generally speaking, yeah. Aim for what you want to be eating and doing at your healthy weight, provided that your personal target weight is within 20 pounds of where you're at now.
Yeah.
If it's greater than that, it's going to be in your best interest to seek professional guidance.
Right.
Just to make sure, because if you're really serious about this and you want it to happen now, like, it can happen pretty damn fast. But if you want it to happen that as fast as possible without you wanting to gnaw your arm off or doing something potentially otherwise unhealthy or unsafe,
right,
have someone help you with it. It doesn't even have to be us.
Right.
There's lots of good. There's Noom, there's Precision Nutrition, there's loads of stuff. But within the context of cycling coaching, we have a deep nutritional ability to guide people. That's why we're having this podcast, right?
Yeah.
So ultimately, it kind of doesn't matter. Coming back to your point that it's different if you have too much muscle or too much fat, I would kind of argue it doesn't matter because
it's more about just caloric intake versus caloric output. Your body's going to take it from somewhere.
Right. So what we want is a caloric deficit without having a nutritional deficit. We want to be ever so slightly underfed without being malnourished at all.
How slight is slight?
Great question. So the rule of thumb that I give, and obviously this is, I'm going to give a singular number. And what's really probably more appropriate is a range depending on
sliding
size
scale for sure.
Whatever. But I'll put the middle of that range, generally speaking, right around 300 calories a day.
Yeah.
That is about the amount that you want to underfuel yourself by. Sort of if you're training, regardless of the amount of weight you want to lose. Up to 25 pounds.
Right.
If you're if the amount of weight you want to lose is between 1 and 25 pounds, you want to shoot for a 300 calorie a day deficit. And I don't really, well.
You'll peel about a pound a week, maybe a little bit slower than that.
Yeah, it's so a pound of calories is like 3,300 or 3,600.
Correct.
So at a 300 calorie a day deficit, 300 times 7, you're looking at, what is that, 24, 27, 28? Was that? No, 2,100 calories a week?
Yeah
2,100 calories a week, which it works out to, 0.6, 0.7 of a pound, roughly speaking.
Yeah.
And if you continue doing that over time, that will net, if you weigh yourself weekly, at about the same time, you should net about a pound a week. And if it's not a full pound a week, don't freak out. If it's a pound and a half 1 week, great. But if you're down 2, 3 or more pounds in 1 week, that's a sign that you're probably pushing things a little too hard.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, though, if you aim to get the amount of protein that you will need at your healthy body weight and you're eating 80% whole foods, generally speaking, you will be pretty safe on your nutrition,
yep.
on your vitamins and nutrients. So we want to have all of our vitamin nutrients, all the nutritional content. We want to be fully nourished, but ever so slightly short on calories.
Yeah.
And so it's really important to understand that the nutrition component, when we're talking about vitamins and minerals and nutrients, is separate from the amount of calories you get.
Yep.
For those who are really well versed in training peaks speak, and metrics and stuff like that, calories is kind of like TSS. It tells us the overall volume of whatever was done, whatever the system produced or was input.
Total work output.
But your TSS, the amount of TSS you get, doesn't tell us what kind of intervals you did, what kind of energy systems did we hit, what kind of development was made.
TSS analogy is the nutritional content of your diet. So make sure you're hitting your intervals, get your liver in.
Yeah, exactly.
get your electrolytes, hit your salt.
Exactly. And if you, generally speaking for our athletes, if you kind of look at the nutritional component of the Apex protocol, give you some rough guidelines of what we want to be shooting for there. Again, podcast 150. If you're not in the coaching family, we go over this in a little bit more detail. But ultimately, figure out what your goal weight is. Understand that especially if you don't have a ton of muscle tone and definition at the moment, upper body in your core, lower body, some or anywhere. As you go down this path, if your protein is where it needs to be on a regular basis and you're strength training and you're doing aerobic training, you're going to build muscle too, where it's needed.
Inadvertently.
And that's important to take into account if you're in sort of the more early phases of your training career and you're still in a space where you're making really big leaps and bounds in your strength and fitness on every 6 to 8 weeks. Understand that you may also really be building a lot of muscle at the same time. Or if you've recently incorporated more strength training into your cycling training overall, you're probably likely to see some poundage of muscle go on. And I don't mean anything extreme. I mean, somewhere in the neighborhood for most folks, it's like 3 to 8 pounds of muscle on average.
Yeah.
There are certainly people who don't put on any muscle, and there's certainly people who put on more than that. Kind of just depends on where you're starting from.
Yeah.
But understand that can have an impact. You know, if I'm trying to lose 15 pounds in 15 weeks, but if you gain 5 pounds of muscle in there, that kind of thing can be a problem. So I encourage my athletes to only weigh themselves once a week.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't get obsessed with your scale. If you're climbing on your scale every day, and especially at different times, be sure to weigh yourself once a week at a consistent time. Let's say right when you wake up after your morning coffee and worship at the porcelain goddess.
The PRD. The pre-race dump.
Uh-huh. After that, go ahead and go weigh yourself. That's a good time to check in, good time to hit consistent weight targets. See where you're at. And don't get upset with where you're going. Just like Noah was saying, so much of this is about BMI, body composition, as opposed to a specific weight. And you'll likely be putting on muscle if you're training up the first time or coming back and training it again. And so don't get obsessed with the scale. Focus on what matters, is that changing your body composition is really your ultimate goal. And
so what are the markers of that we can look at along the way? So we don't want to look at the scale. What I like to tell my athletes to focus on is, number one, how's your performance doing on paper? Are you still hitting your intervals? Is your CTL still going in the direction that we want it to? That's great. That's important. That's really focus point number one, is that we don't want our weight loss to compromise our on-the-bike trajectory and performance. It is possible to lose weight gradually while
training up.
Without forcing a plateau in your strength or fitness. And so that's sort of priority number one. So if you're still training well, everything's going fine on the bike, generally speaking, we're in the green, right? And then thing number two, how do you look in the mirror? How's your clothes fitting? Those kinds of things, the actual telltale signs of recomposition. And then finally, and not necessarily least important, could be most important, but how do you feel? How do you feel? You should feel notably different every 5 pounds you lose, right? So every month or so, kind of do a little self-assessment, right? How's it feeling going up the stairs? How's it feeling putting your clothes on? How are we feeling going up the hills on the bike? You know, how's your energy throughout the day? The energy throughout the day is really key, because if you don't have good energy throughout the day, that's a good indicator that you're malnourished. And when we're malnourished and we're low on energy, we're highly likely to make a poor nutritional decision. Ooh. And so that's where the crash diets really fall off, and kind of that rebound effect that you were talking about earlier. It's not just physiological. I think the psychological conditions that it sets up are equally as important, right? When you're malnourished, underfed, and really tired and really groggy, and you've done that for a while, you're very likely to make a rash decision and eat an entire tub of Ben & Jerry's. You're very likely to eat an entire pizza. And that can invert all of the progress that you just made. And so slow and steady is really the key here. And you should be able to do this entire process without ever feeling like you're starving yourself, without ever feeling really mentally foggy, without ever feeling really moody. Now, if we're really fatigued from training and we're shooting for a small deficit,
you're going to be tired.
Yeah, you're not going to be feeling A+ perfect, but there's a sweet spot that we want to live in there of just a little bit off of perfect. But if we start to go too far into the hole, nutritionally, training wise, or both in combination together, we can set up the conditions for a rebound in a regressive way. So ultimately, the idea is check in with how you're feeling, right? You should feel basically fine. You should feel basically normal. You shouldn't feel like you're starving yourself. You shouldn't feel foggy or fatigued or grumpy or anything like that. And I think that is very common for a lot of people who go on diets or who initiate a weight loss journey.
That they expect to feel that way, or that they do? Both.
The majority of people, I would say, expect to feel that way. And I think that expectation is what scares people away from making a serious change in their diet.
Right.
And I would counter that with, most of what's suggested out there right now will set you up for these conditions, right?
Yeah.
Some kind of all carnivore diet, some kind of all vegan diet, right. Some kind of, you're doing keto, right? Something like that, where it's very exclusionary and you're really just eating a few things and your macros are kind of weird.
You have an incomplete diet ultimately.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things can set you up for bad rebounds. And so ultimately, I think if you're, if you're not malnourishing yourself, you're not undernourished anywhere, you're getting all your vitamins and nutrients, 80% of your diet's coming from whole foods, and you're getting the amount of protein you need, all the other boxes are checked down the line, we can go a little bit light on calories and your body isn't going to suffer any damage overnight.
Right.
You're not going to have an inability to rebuild. You're not going to have any immunocompromisation, or at least those things are going to be hugely mitigated.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's interesting too, for a lot of people listening right now, there is actually a really strong chance that you're already eating a caloric deficit. And so what I find with a lot of the folks that I work with, it's, kind of understanding the caloric needs are a lot higher than you're probably currently eating.
Mm-hmm.
Really difficult to nail it on accident. And it's getting all that nutrition in there so that your body stabilizes and goes, ah, we're getting what we need now. We can start getting rid of some of these extra fat resources.
Yeah.
Because your body enters into a cycle where it basically trusts that you're going to put back what it needs
right.
every day. So it gets rid of everything it has in the warehouse.
I like that. Trust. And when you lose that, yeah, you have these wild swings when the right food starts to go back in.
The second echelon is brought to you by Belgium Racing Experience, premier racing camps in Belgium since 2011. We've taken over 100 athletes to race in Belgium since 2011, nearly 10% of which turned professional in some capacity, and 2023 will mark the accumulation of 2.5 years worth of racing camps for BRE. The only other American program with stats like that is the national team. For summer 2023, we are offering separate sessions for elite men 19 and up, elite women 19 and up, junior men 17 and 18, and the bucket list experience in 1 week chunks for folks who want to join the BRE action but aren't exclusively focused on racing themselves. Follow along at Belgium Racing on Instagram and check out BelgiumRacingExperience.com for more details. Spots are filling quickly. Secure yours with a deposit today. You can email me directly at Noah@WilliamsRacingAcademy.com, contact us through BelgiumRacingExperience.com, or even DM us on Instagram. We look forward to seeing you in Belgium next summer.
Get 20% off your Mode CBD order with code ECHELON20. Mode CBD is a family-owned, American-grown, American-made CBD tincture, topical roll-on, gummies, and more. At their own food-grade lab facility in Florida, Mode CBD creates a proprietary nano-CBD molecule that's 1/1,000,000th of its original size, enabling the fastest and most complete CBD absorption on the market. I've personally used a myriad of different CBD products from as many different brands, and Mode CBD is by far and away the highest quality and most effective CBD I have ever tried. If you need relief from occasional chronic soreness, sleeplessness, anxiety, try Mode CBD out today and use code ECHELON20 to get 20% off of your order. That's code ECHELON20, all one word at checkout, for 20% off all Mode CBD.
What sort of weird... Just, and this is slightly off topic, what sort of weird diets have you tried, have you done?
I was plant-based for like a short period. It wasn't really my choice. It was something I think we did for like a week or two.
Okay.
In our house. But we did a lot of diets as a family. So mm-hmm. I did paleo for a while. I've done Whole30. I've done, like I mentioned, we did like a plant-forward thing for a little bit.
Mm.
But I've never done... keto, and I've never like strictly done Atkinson. We did do Beachbody for a while. We did Palm Beach for a while.
Palm Beach.
And so kind of been around the block. I've done Weight Watchers.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay.
And then I've been through Precision Nutrition Training.
Which is
pretty good.
Sound.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good concepts.
Good concept.
Not especially well written, but that's
great,
beside the point.
Great foundation.
Yeah.
Read the typos in it.
Kind of makes me want to pull my eyes.
Yeah,
out,
sort of make me want to slam my head into things. Yeah.
But point being is that I don't think there's any one like particular dogmatic way, not even carnivore. I would say if it were going to be anything, I would probably do some sort of carnivore style diet.
And that makes sense because you're getting your fats and your proteins, and your body can turn protein into carbohydrate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So gluconeogenesis.
Yeah. So you can, it's slow and a calorically.
It's the only exclusionary diet.
High cost process.
Yeah. It's the least nutritionally deficient
exclusionary diet.
Yeah.
I agree.
And so for a lot of people, especially because even a lot of the whole foods that we get today from the grocery store are loaded with all kinds of, you know, industrial synthetic pesticides and fertilizers and stuff like that. You know, there's, depending on how deep down the rabbit hole you want to get, there's antibiotics in all the meat. You know, a lot of the chicken and pork you get from the grocery store has never seen the light of day in its entire life. And it's kind of a dark place. And so for a lot of people who have developed chronic autoimmune reactions to some of these more you know, it's not going to be on the ingredient sheet. Some of it is, but a lot of this stuff isn't because it's so far upstream in the food production process as an additive. Like, you don't, there's not a list of the pesticides and fertilizers on the side of the carrots.
Right.
But those are in there.
Or on the side of the beef.
Right, exactly.
The food, like what was it eating, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you don't know. Like another thing, right? So a lot of grocery store chicken and pork is fed like a predominantly soy and corn diet.
Right.
But chicken and pork don't naturally eat soy and corn.
Hmm.
And that's what they eat in an industrial setting. They'll eat that their entire lives. Yeah. In addition to food waste and food scrap, which I think is great. Like that's they're great at.
Sure. That'd be fun. As long as it doesn't contain the wrapper still.
No, but when you have an Amazon warehouse full of pigs and chickens, you're not bringing in, you know, garbage trucks full of compost for them to rummage through and find their own nutrients. You're bringing in truckloads full of feed.
Yeah.
And the cheapest feed is the corn and soy stuff. And so that's what we feed the chickens and the pigs. And that's not at all what they're designed to eat for their whole life.
Yeah, not to mention they're not moving the way they should or living in the societies that they naturally would and the way they should. And yeah, we're getting meat out that's not nutritionally dense. Yeah, it's protein. And the difference in protein quality isn't there, but the difference in nutritional quality absolutely is.
Huge, huge. And so, yeah, without going down too much of a rabbit hole, but point is that I think for folks who have over time developed sensitivities, allergens, autoimmune responses to some of these food production practices that are out of sync with nature, going to only eating locally sourced, nutrient dense foods like eggs and meat and fish to a lesser or different degree. There's other ways to get fatty acids in and stuff like that. But fish is a good one, depending on where you're getting it from. And so kind of excluding yourself, excluding everything except for locally sourced, really, really clean, naturally raised meat for a lot of people is the safest way out. And I know for myself, when I eat more meat and I reduce the amount of other stuff, but I'm like a little bit responsive to dairy. I'm very responsive to gluten in a negative way.
Mm.
And there's a lot of other things that I've never tried fully stripping out before, like oils and stuff like that, that I don't know. But I know when I eat predominantly meat and a little bit of vegetable, a little bit of potato, a little bit of rice, I feel great.
You feel so good.
I feel so good.
I do get, and this is a strange thing to mention, definitely off topic. Mm. Every time I eat chicken, my face itches.
Whoa, that's weird.
Which is strange, right?
Yeah.
I keep asking around to see if it is a thing that other people experience. It may just be me.
No, yeah. Hit us up with an email or let me know on Instagram if your face itches when you eat chicken. Mm. But there could be something to that. There's a lot of weird stuff going on with chickens right now.
There's a lot of strange things going on with chicken.
With the eggs.
Well, there's this company doing kind of this Monsanto situation where they're giving they sell feed and they're selling feed to other people that's nutritionally deficient.
Dude, I think we have this feed.
I'm
pretty sure it's Purina feed.
It's Purina feed. Yeah. Because they're doing that.
Yeah.
They're selling feed that's nutritionally deficient so that the chickens eating it won't lay. But they'll survive. They can live on it, but you're not going to get good quality egg. And then they're giving their own chickens good feed. Because they raise chickens. They're like financially interested in screwing everyone else over.
And
some Monsanto shit, dude.
Tinfoil hat on nice and tight right now. But there is also a rash of articles and news about how bad and unsafe it is to have chickens at home.
Ooh. Okay. All right.
Yeah. No. The food production is kind of my pocket passion. So I can go down this for a while. But point is, you want to eat as clean as possible. And when I say clean, I mean whole foods. And if you zoom in on whole foods, I mean getting enough real meat protein in and the other nutrients that come along with that, eggs, red meat, white meat, fish, so on and so forth. That really needs to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 50% of your diet. generally speaking, that's kind of what, in order to get enough protein for you to be optimally healthy at your optimal weight, that's roughly what it breaks down to. Broadly speaking, the more athletic activity you do, you know, if you're like in the 12 hours a week and up on the bike range, that meat will be a little bit less of what you eat because you need to eat more carbohydrate.
Your caloric load is just massive, and what you're spending when you're moving is carb.
Huge, yeah. Right. So point is, you want to identify your goal weight, set your goal protein, and understand that you're shooting for a roughly 300 calorie a day deficit. That's going to net you about a pound a week. A
pound every week and a half, right. Somewhere in there.
If you're trying to figure out how long it's going to take you to lose that weight, if you're training at the same time at full speed, right? Like right now, we're coming into the racing season. Nobody should be taking a month off to lose weight. you want to not give yourself less weeks than you have pounds to lose. Mm. Right. So yep. If you have 5 pounds to lose, I would give yourself 6 or 7 weeks. If you have 10 pounds to lose, wow, I'm really screwing that up right now.
No, you're good.
If you have 10 pounds to lose, give yourself 12, maybe 13 weeks.
Yeah.
Especially because, again, we got to add in for the fact that if you do this right, you may probably good chance that you build a little bit of muscle during that time. And so that can slow the process down. And you don't want to plan on really being perfect throughout any of this.
I was going to say, leave a little room for error, a little wiggle room for your own
races, personal, big training blocks, a little vacation here or there. Something's going on.
Holiday happens. There's a birthday.
Holidays.
Whatever you know.
Yeah. Life. Don't be so gluten-free that you don't eat grandma's pie.
Yeah, please eat grandma's pie. Life's too short not to eat grandma's pie.
Yeah, don't be that guy. And that, again, that's where we come back to 80-20, long-term sustainability. You know, if you have a one-month period where like, I'm losing weight hardcore, like, okay, if you know there's going to be a holiday in there, understand that you're going to eat a little bit, have some moderation, right? Mm. But don't abstain altogether. Like, food is love. Right. Food is part of community. So don't be that guy that's like, sorry, I can't eat what we're having at this dinner party because it's whatever, bean soup made with soybean oil.
Yeah. You know,
like, just have a no thank you portion. Have a little bit and plan on having some steak later or before.
The other part of this we haven't mentioned yet is that if you're really focused on losing weight, trim it down, cut out alcohol.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If especially, and I'm not saying forever, but especially during this period where you're trying to lose weight, like 2 drinks a week or less.
Yeah.
Or less.
Right.
Ideally zero. If you can go zero alcohol for the number of weeks that you need to lose, the number of pounds that you need to lose, it will smooth that process
exponentially
out
easier for you.
Absolutely. Another, like, and one of the big reasons for this is that when you drink, it totally triggers your blood glucose roller coaster. So the next day, 2 days, 3 days, your body is going to be screaming at you for more of that sweet, simple, direct carbohydrate. Yep. And your cravings for suboptimal nutrition items
are going to dramatically increase
through the roof.
Yeah.
And also, when you don't give your body that, your body's going to crash. And then you're going to feel like crap.
Really terrible.
And that's going
until you dump some more in.
And that's going to also make you want to eat something. Yeah. And so mentally, you want to understand that that's coming down the pipeline for you. And if you just want to avoid that like temptation and that whole process altogether, just don't drink. Don't drink. Certainly not more than like one. Again, 2 a week tops.
Yeah.
And I think even then, when you drop down to 2 a week, I think you'll realize the impact that those two have. Mm. You'll enjoy them more, but your sensitivity is going to go up.
Yeah.
And that's actually a good thing.
It is. Every time I am having a discussion with an athlete that's starting to cut out alcohol, and even not even people trying to lose weight necessarily, but just people trying to dial in on the training plan and hit their numbers and achieve what they can achieve, they're always blown away. And they always just... they'll jump on the phone 2 weeks after you have them back off. And for a half hour, they'll just be like, oh my goodness, I just feel so good. It's amazing. I sleep and I wake up. I didn't even know I was not feeling rested, but I woke up feeling rested in the first time in years. It was amazing. And they'll do that for a half hour.
Mm-hmm. It's like, I had dreams.
Yeah.
It's great. It's really great. But no, at this point, I mean, I've personally gained and lost 50 pounds. I've helped other people lose 20 plus pounds, probably somewhere between a half dozen and a dozen times mm-hmm. at this point. It's a common thing. And I've helped virtually all of my clients shave 5 pounds at some point. Mm-hmm. And those who we didn't were the folks that actually needed to gain weight. Mm-hmm. And that's where, again, some professional guidance can really come into play.
Definitely.
And make sure, because honestly, you know, again, just to kind of come back to the top and run through a quick summary, you know, the World Tour pros you see on TV, when you're seeing them race, they're not at a weight that's healthy or sustainable.
No. And they didn't start out their professional careers at that weight.
Not at all.
They started out significantly larger.
One of my favorite ones to kind of reference in this is go back and find photos of Chris Froome or Bradley Wiggins.
He was jacked.
Yeah, in their Continental and Pro Conti days. Mm-hmm. And even their first year or two in the World Tour.
Yeah.
They are much, much rounder, and they go. It's like they became president or something, and mm-hmm. the life just gets sucked out of them.
Yeah, they start to look 60 and they're 40.
Yeah,
and Annemiek van Vleuten has the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. You look at her early career,
mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, twice the size she is now, and now she is unbelievably tiny,
so lean,
like looks like she's made out of bike tubing.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Crazy.
It's amazing. And I don't have any opinion about the attractiveness of either direction. You know, I was raised inside of cycling, and an athlete to me, somebody who takes care of their body and they're in good condition.
It takes all sizes, all types. I've been beaten by guys smaller than me. I've been beaten by guys bigger than me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Same. And ultimately, though, what you're looking at on TV when we're looking at the Van Vleutens and the Pogachars and these folks that are like bean pole, ultra lightweight, you got to understand that is a result of very precise nutrition that allows them to get down to that weight without – it's like the finest line. It's absolutely as small as they can be without being utterly fragile and frail.
Right.
And I would argue – If you look at it, and I think a lot of other guys who have been watching pro cycling for 20 or more years would agree that the athletes are more frail now. Like,
by a long way. They, if someone crashes, it's almost a guarantee they're going to break something.
I would say it used to be when there was a big pileup or crash, given, you know, pick a random rider out of the group.
Yeah.
There was like 20 to 25%, maybe a 30% chance that they would have to retire because of injuries they sustained during the crash. Now, granted, this was also during the doping era, but not everybody wasn't on steroids, the kind of shit that makes you just like, that wasn't the kind of dope. We're talking about like aerobic doping, basically, not stuff
pushing the blood volume to the absolute limit.
Right. That's the kind of stuff that allows you to recover better overnight, but isn't going to give you some type of advantage in the amount of damage you can take.
Right.
We're not talking about football player doping. We're not talking about military doping. We're not talking about UFC doping.
This is a totally different animal.
Different kind of doping.
Yeah.
Right. We have the same doping that the figure skaters and curlers use.
Okay. The curlers.
They do, though. Look into it.
So funny.
Yeah. Not everybody dopes. We're largely in a clean sport era. But my point of comparison is to say that our athletes are less durable now. And I'm comparing them directly to an area where doping was more prevalent. Mm. But the argument I'm making to that is that the doping that they were doing wasn't necessarily going to make them more durable in terms of a singular acute impact.
No, it wasn't geared towards longevity for them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Glass, kind of turning them into glass cannons. But
right.
Nowadays, I mean, these guys are fragile.
And I would argue that that's partially a result of the removal of doping.
Mm.
Because when you look at the numbers and the speeds and the VAM and the times that we have now, many of the pro cyclists we have now can hit or exceed the numbers and the records that were hit during the doping days.
Absolutely.
But they are doing it clean or cleaner.
Cleaner. Yeah.
Mostly clean.
Sure.
Cleanish.
Cleanish.
And that's impressive.
They're definitely not doped. I mean, those guys back then, they were doped to the eyeballs. It was so
all
hardcore.
The way, every inch. But point is, a big part of that speed delta that's been made up is through, you know, our obsession with power to weight ratio.
Yep.
How light can we make ourselves?
The tracking of biometrics and allowing us to walk that line like you were talking about.
Right.
Now we can accurately gauge what exactly an athlete needs to get right, just right there, and we can hold them there.
Exactly. But that's what you do when there's hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars on the line, and we're talking about grand tours and world championships and stuff.
This is not
that
something
line,
you do for Unbound.
Exactly. That line is not something we walk even for Masters National Championships, not for Junior National Championships, not for not even for going to the kermesses in Belgium.
Right.
Right. It's
no,
that
I mean,
is,
you better be the beefier the better headed to
really,
the kermesses in Belgium.
I mean, again, coming back to the come up of Froome and Wiggins and stuff like that, that you in order to get yourself to be a World Tour, Grand Tour rider outside of the Pogacars and stuff like that, who are sort of unicorns, if you will.
Yeah.
But for everybody else that actually had to like grind and earn their way up to that point, grind is the key word there. It's a lot of racing. It's a lot of intensity. When you're racing that much, you're hitting the ground 2-3 times a season. Most of the time, it's not a big deal, but you gotta keep going.
You have to have something to grind.
Because if you are too fragile, you are too frail on the come up, you won't continue to get opportunities.
Mm.
And that's not to say that like we have to push through injury. Certainly back in the day, you know, the health of the riders was not really respected nearly as much as it is today. It's a lot more respected if you say, hey, like I've got some knee pain, or like my head's not right, or, you know, I've got some chest pain, or, you know, I'm feeling like I might be getting sick. You know, if you're already a professional athlete, they will preserve their investment in you as an athlete. But on the way up, nobody's looking out for you.
No.
And that's one of the biggest roles that I play for my elite level athletes, is like making sure that they have the space and the understanding that it's actually their job and their duty to communicate when something's not 100% right. Because if you continue going full throttle on that repeatedly, just like a car, something bigger is going
to
break.
Yeah. And when it does, you're going to have to take even more time off, and ultimately you're limiting yourself.
Exactly. And then you'll really miss opportunities.
Yeah.
So there's a balance to strike, and the weight that you see at the World Tour and the professional ranks is not necessarily it's not the weight sort of
it's not what we want to achieve as
BMI.
Amateurs or as elites or as even low level professionals.
No, it's different demands and different sort of scenario. And so ultimately you shouldn't be too aggressive with what you want to look like. I think, you know, even as amateur and elite level amateur cyclists, we should be well-rounded athletes.
Mm.
And that's one thing you don't see quite as explicitly with those Grand Tour, World Tour pros. They're not well-rounded. Why aren't they well-rounded? Well, coming back to that,
because they're the pinnacle.
Exactly. It's coming back to that spectrum between adaptability and optimization.
They're fully optimized.
When you're fully optimized for a Grand Tour, you are less adaptable to more demanding, more strenuous situations.
Yeah.
A la when you hit the ground, something's more likely to break because there's less of you to protect yourself.
Mm.
And yes, that allows you to go up the mountain faster, but it also means that if you fall off that mountain, there is a 40% higher chance that you're actually not getting back in the race. And that's why we see so many retirements and stuff like that, is because of this fragility. Broadly speaking,
you know,
there's guys like Tony Martin and Primoz Roglic, and I don't know why they're all Jumbo guys, but they are.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
But they, you know, that could take several hits and keep going. But even Primoz, you know, there's a limit, right? There's a limit. Now, shouldn't hit the ground that much.
No,
but
that's my argument. don't crash your bike, please.
Yes. So, yeah, we're getting a little off topic here, but the point of that tangent was to say that your aspiration in terms of if you're kind of on your own in terms of like determining what weight you should be at or what you think you should look like or for optimal performance on the bike, it's not like that. It's not like the World Tour pros. It's something a lot more balanced and manageable. One of the you know, he's not a cyclist, but somebody I would point to as being what to look for and like what's possible if you eat really clean and don't do really anything else, you know, no steroids, just basic sort of physical attributes and ability. I would look at, you know, somebody like Ben Patrick, for example. He's the founder of ATG, strength coaching and stuff like that. And he's extremely aesthetic, and he's in his upper 30s, about to turn 40, something like that. He has a partner in his business. He goes by Mr. Infinity. For our athletes, you'll recognize that Mr. Infinity makes the slant board that we recommend getting for our Apex mobility routine. And I'm forgetting what Mr. Infinity's name is. I think it's Derek something, but he is like 45 years old and absolutely shredded. I don't necessarily mean jacked, but how shredded and toned and aesthetic you can be if you just focus on athletic fundamentals and a clean eating and no other kind of BS or anything.
Plyometrics,
like that.
Mobility, the body basics. Weight stuff, and clean eating.
You can get very, very lean and be very healthy and durable all at the same time. Mm-hmm. But shooting in that direction with a key focus on durability and longevity, that's what we're looking to keep with our athletes that you're not seeing at the World Tour. Mm. Their longevity is a window of 5 years. And after that, they can go back to eating more. I mean, take a look at any World Tour pro like a year or two after they retired, yeah. Outside of Phil Gaiman.
Right.
Do you want to look like Phil Gaiman?
No.
Exactly. I rest my case.
Yeah.
So a balanced target, understand that it's a mindset, it's a lifestyle, something that should be sustainable over an indefinite period of time.
Right. Like 2 years from now, you can be back at the weight you were previously because you tried to crash diet this situation. And you're going to be in, you know, in an unsustainable place. Or 2 years from now, you can be exactly where you want to on a lifestyle that's going to continue to support you.
Exactly.
Choose right.
While you're losing weight, aim for a caloric deficit, not more than 300 calories a day sustainably. You can have a day or two where it's 400, 500, or 600, but you can't do that every day, back to back to back to back.
You can't even do that every other day.
Can't even do it every other day. So yeah. Kind of shoot for a 300 calorie deficit. But if you're hitting that 80-20 on whole foods and making sure that you're getting in enough protein and that's coming from some type of animal-based source, generally speaking, you should meet your nutritional demands because we want to be in a caloric deficit, but not in a nutritional deficit.
Right. That's when your body's going to start reconstituting things, taking muscles from other locations to break down certain areas so they can rebuild, take calcium from your bones, take collagen from your ligaments and tendons. We don't want that. You really, all the rest of the stuff, all the rest of you really should stay
in place
and as it is, if not also getting better. And that can all happen simultaneously. You do just have to be careful about it and track it. Oh, food tracking. Real quick.
Oh, yeah. MyFitnessPal is kind of the standard go-to for tracking food. They've got a really good library of the nutritional caloric content of foods. As it concerns in regards tracking, there's a number of people who will benefit from that structure and catalog and accountability that comes from doing it constantly and consistently. I typically recommend that folks do it for 3 to 5 days, and then we draw averages from that on those macronutrients and on that caloric content. And as well, that gives us a good sample size, ideally, of what a standard like week of eating. What's typically available to this athlete? What are their standard preferences? And from there, we get rid of the foods that are not serving us at all, and we modulate the servings and portions of the foods that are to meet our macronutrient targets. So typically, we can accomplish setting our trajectory towards sustainable weight loss with only 3 to 5 days of nutritional tracking for most people.
Yeah.
And it can be your preference to continue with that. Most people don't prefer tracking their stuff all the time. So just doing it for 3 to 5 days to get a good sample, and then we can make our recommendations and our adjustments on that, and then it's up to you to apply those things, and we should see the results in, again, how you look in the mirror, how you feel, and in the performance and training data. Mm. And the scale underneath all of those should also generally reflect the trend, but we're not looking to the scale as our primary indicator of progress.
You were saying every 5 pounds you lose, you feel different, and I've never had to lose weight. So would you just walk me through what every 5 pounds, what that index feels like? Because in my mind, potentially it's similar to when you gain CTL. You know, when you go from 70 to 80, like every like 5 to 10 CTL, you feel different.
Yeah, for sure.
So how's would you be able to describe that for me?
Yeah, in some sense, I would say where you feel it most acutely is uphills, really. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's probably the predictable cliche answer, but it is as direct as you imagine. I mean,
that's where you're noticing it. Yeah.
Yeah, because as a, you know, if it doesn't matter if you're a bigger or a smaller athlete, if you're pushing around extra weight, you're used to, you know, most people listening to this podcast should know roughly exactly the intensity of a body weight squat.
Yep.
If all of a sudden your body weight squat gets 20% easier,
That's crazy.
You notice.
And it's like doing body weight squats for a long time with a weighted vest. Wouldn't even take much. 15-pound weighted vest. Mm-mm. And you do body weight squats for a month, you know, say 50 a day. And the next month you take that 15 pounds out. That's going to be hilarious.
It's massive. It's massive. And so I would say it's you know, palpable in 5 pound increments.
Okay.
But it's just like wearing a weight vest for things. If you're on flat ground most of the time, you're not really going to notice except for in your ability to accelerate.
Okay.
You know, attacks, sprints, things like that are going to be a little bit snappier. Mm. But otherwise, you won't notice at all for the most part.
Okay.
You will lose an advantage on the downhills.
Right.
Where you used to just slide forward. You have passed everybody. Now you're just kind of stuck. But it way more than makes up for it when you start going up a hill and you're like, have this mental expectation. You're like mentally clenching.
It's
going
to be. It's going to be.
But then that, it never happens.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Like, and it's totally worth it. But I would also argue, especially to listeners of this podcast, I'm going to put this exactly in the same bucket as Apex strength and mobility. It's not just on the bike. You feel better all the time, all day long.
When you go into a low cabinet to pick up a spray bottle and you come back up.
Getting back up off the floor.
Do you notice it then?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Getting back up off the floor. You notice it going up a short flight of stairs. Mm. You notice it walking up hills.
Wow.
Especially if you live somewhere at altitude. Holy shit. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. Yeah, you notice it pretty much all the time. And that also coincides with putting clothes on and them fitting a little bit baggier. Mm. And then it's like that boost of confidence.
Ooh.
That's way more a boost of confidence for most people and for me than seeing that I lost a pound and a half.
Right.
Pound and a half, okay, whatever.
Like,
but,
sure.
But if I got to cinch that belt a little tighter or if I put on my favorite shirt
but
and I'm like kind
good.
Of floating around in it a little bit and then I get up off the ground and I go walk up my stairs and I'm like, oh, that wasn't. I'm
it
not
was
winded.
So easy.
Yeah. That just translates to on the bike. Fundamentally, I mean, say it all the time, right? Health is the foundation of performance. Mm. And optimal health also involves being at your optimal weight.
Yep.
Low, high is bad for you. You
right.
want to be at your optimal, sustainable, happy weight. Mm. And realistically, if you just eat well and you work out sometimes, you don't even have to be a cyclist.
Your body will sit there.
You'll get there and you'll stay there. It's not hard. What's hard is the temptation in societal norms. We've got soybean oil loaded food.
And everything. Everything's fried.
Everywhere you turn, man. It's on the cooktop. It's in the fryer. It's in the bread.
If you go out, you drink.
That's normal. We drink for everything. And so it's really figuring out how to navigate that temptation and develop. Just like getting out of bed on time.
Mm.
You don't want to do that. But you develop the skill of doing it, and eventually it becomes very easy. It becomes your normal.
Mm.
And it's the same way with avoiding really crappy food options when possible. You know what I mean?
Right.
Again, it's not – we live in America. Unless you go move off-grid somewhere, you're probably not just going to get beef and water without somebody looking at you weird. So there's a balance. And as well for traveling and racing and stuff like that, there's a balance. But ultimately, the standard American diet, the SAD diet, involves way too much alcohol.
The SAD diet.
It is the SAD diet.
It is a sad-ass diet, isn't it?
Involves way too much alcohol, way too many preservatives, way too much shelf-stable food, a ton of synthetic pesticides, fertilizers, antibiotics that are going in way upstream that aren't on the nutrition label. The nutrition label of most you know, foods that you find at the grocery store are actually 50% or more BS. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
I was gonna say it's all gonna be extremely vague. It's hard to find, like, what? Yeah, it's carb in this, but what carb is it? Because
right.
that matters to a lot of people.
Yeah.
People have certain sensitivities to different ones, and like I know for me, maltodextrin.
Mm.
If I
mm-hmm.
don't
Very
intake
common.
It regularly, and then I try to take in a bunch of it,
mm-hmm.
ruins my gut.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
very common.
Mm-hmm.
Very common. So there's a balance to strike. I don't remember what the initial question. Oh yeah, how do you feel? But yeah,
how do you feel?
At you know, if you lose 10 pounds, it's I would say it's somewhere in the neighborhood of getting to 100 CTL the first time.
Ooh. Oh.
Except for if you keep it off, you keep it forever.
Which is nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where to keep 100 CTL, you got to keep pedaling.
Yeah. And I don't mean that you like, it's not like literally that you keep fitness or anything like that, but in terms of the sensation of ability,
mm-hmm.
how you feel in your meat vehicle.
Yep.
You, yeah.
It permanently feels baseline, permanently better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should do a thing where we do like a week where we wear just like a 20-pound weighted vest.
I'm so down.
That'd
you don't even
hilarious.
Know how game I am.
It'd be so good. That'd be.
It would be.
It'd be a lot of fun. But anyway, yeah, I definitely am for folks losing weight if they feel like they need to.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody who feels like they need to
actually
needs to. Some people may need to gain weight.
Yeah.
But
like I'm, and as a frame of reference, as an example, I feel like I need to lose weight
mm-hmm.
frequently, you
mm-hmm.
know, and I don't.
Mm-mm.
I'm fine.
You're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a balance point. You want to look like a healthy, athletic human being.
Yeah.
You don't want to look like a beanpole, and you don't want to look, you know, like
you don't
heavy.
Look, you don't want to look like Arnold, and you don't want to look...
Especially if you actually
inflamed.
Spend a lot of time training, and you actually have some level of capability on the bike.
Mm.
And I'm speaking from experience here, because I grew up... and everyone, like all of my schoolmates and stuff like that, thought I was like some alien from Mars.
Yeah.
I shaved my legs.
Right.
And I did these 100-mile rides.
Mm-hmm.
And, I, you know, supposedly I went to Europe and I'm some kind of like super athlete.
Right.
But I can't out-squat anyone. I can't outrun anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not particularly good at throwing or catching anything.
Mm.
Like, it's... You're... What is that athletic performance? You
right.
know what I mean? And especially then... particularly later in my teen years, I really struggled with my weight a lot. It's part of the reason why I'm so passionate about mastering this now and making it simple for people,
mm-hmm.
because it was a very real struggle for me on a performance end of things, on an emotional, psychological end
health,
of things, health end of things.
Yeah.
Huge, huge. And ultimately, it can be really crushing if you actually have ability on the bike, but you can't look in the mirror and be like proud of what you're doing,
yeah.
or you don't feel like you have the ability to navigate the world off the bike in an athletic manner,
yeah,
in a capable manner.
Absolutely.
You know?
So that's this apex mobility, just the tightness of my hips alone growing up, the tightness of my ankles alone growing up, tightness of my knees alone
mm-hmm.
growing up. Yeah, it definitely took away from a lot of my athletic efficacy.
Totally.
Being able to just do other normal things without injuring myself. Like I had a massive knee injury when I was 15, playing pickup football with my friends. And I guarantee you if I had the mobility that I have now, it might not have gone down that way.
Right.
Mm.
I mean, if I would have had 165 cranks,
I
would be on a different planet, I think.
List.
You know, I didn't realize how hard... I was working to work around those.
Yeah.
And
how much they're inflicting themselves on you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't particularly mobile. Still not. I'm more mobile now because of apex mobility, but I wasn't particularly mobile back then. And it was just like, it honestly, like it keeps me up at night sometimes.
Right. Thinking about just how long.
Yeah.
It was such a machismo thing too. Like, oh, I'm on the biggest cranks possible.
Yeah.
Like, why is that?
Yeah. That was definitely a big part of it.
Why is that cool? You know, like, why was that a thing?
I was proud of being big.
I think it's cool to feel good.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, bigger's not always better in cycling.
Not well. Yeah, that's
unless we're talking about tire size.
But anyway, in which case bigger is typically better.
We should all just be fat bike slicks.
Ooh.
That'd be great.
Ooh.
That'd be great. Anyway.
4-inch slicks.
Yeah. Why
Ooh.
not? Why not?
Couch.
Let's do we should make a bike with motorcycle tires. and do racing on that.
That'd I had a unicycle for a long time with a motorcycle tire,
ooh.
Like an actual motorcycle tire.
Could you actually get up to speed on it?
It was pretty slow,
mm-hmm.
but
stable.
Very stable, super easy to ride, very comfy.
I think I want to try that. I cannot unicycle for my life.
And then it had a little grippy on the front where you could hold it, and that thing would bounce. It was like a little trampoline. Good time.
That's awesome. A little pogo stick bike.
Yeah, I could teach you unicycle in a day.
I'd be down for that.
Hell yeah.
Because that's...
Yeah, I'd get one again.
I can't wheelie, so I should be able to at least unicycle.
Yeah. I also want to make a manual machine.
Mm-hmm.
That's on my list of stuff to do this year.
Good. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, because I also can't wheelie. And I when these like kids pull it off, I just feel inadequate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not great. It's not great.
I can drop them in like 0.8 of a second, but I can't wheelie. It hurts.
Right. I touched on it a little bit earlier, but it just occurred to me one more thing before we kind of sign off on this episode. Again, mentioned at the top, metabolic health, a big element here. You know, if you're looking for aggressive weight loss, one of the tools that I mentioned you can use is doubling up, having 2-a-days, and basically just activating your metabolism regularly so that you're having some kind of activity on two ends of the day, morning and evening, and that there's a gap between them where you're fully coming to a resting state or at least a relatively stagnant state.
Yeah.
But that's something that you can also integrate into regular training. So, you know, whatever your daily training ride is, if you get up and go for a fasted walk 20 minutes in the morning, it could be on a treadmill, doesn't matter. You know, just move around, get your heart rate up a little bit, especially while you're fasted, particularly early in the day. You don't want to be doing anything fasted later in the day. Don't not feed yourself all day. The morning is your only opportunity to do fasted stuff. In order for fasted stuff to work for your metabolism, it has to be at a very low intensity, not any higher than whatever mid-endurance is.
Right.
And for our athletes...
Like speed walking, basically. Yeah. Very light speed walking.
Yeah, exactly. Airport walk tops.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Airport walk.
But... For most of our athletes, the heart rate range that we give you on an endurance ride, that lower end is not actually the bottom of endurance. It's a little above the bottom of endurance. So it's basically, if you're trying to do a fasted walk or a fasted portion of your ride, and you can do a fasted portion of your ride, right? You can add 20, 30 minutes on the front of your ride, do it at a very low intensity, low endurance or lower. Recovery is best, walking on the bike. And then... try to eat something pretty substantial before you transition into whatever your ride is. But ultimately, having a little bit of fasted activity and trying to have more activities throughout the day, but at a very low intensity, just to give your metabolism a little bit of bump. It's not so much about the calories that you're burning during that walk or during that, you know, whether the walk's in the morning or the evening. It's about the fact that your metabolism stays just a little bit hotter for a while afterwards, and you get a little bit of afterglow burn of calories, so to speak, and that can really just help shed extra throughout the process. And especially when you're doing it at a really low intensity, maybe you get a little bit of extra deficit than you're planning on. It's really hard to calculate what that metabolic overrun is from a workout.
Yeah.
But because it's at such a low intensity, your body's not going to do anything weird in response to it.
Right.
You're not going to pay a price for it. You're not going to notice that you're feeling a little fatigued on this walk.
Right.
So using extra metabolic hits throughout the day and recognizing that sleep is one of the most important components to metabolic health. If you want to lose weight, you have to get enough sleep. It's very, very difficult to lose weight in a consistent, sustainable, reliable manner if you're not getting enough sleep, because it's a very important part of the metabolic process for your body. In order to have optimal weight, you have to have optimal or at least good metabolic health. And if your sleep's out of line, you're not going to have good metabolic health.
Yeah, you're SOL.
Exactly. So that was the last thing I wanted to hit before That's we good. Sign off. You got anything That's good. Else?
No, I was thinking on it. I don't think I have anything else. I think we said it all.
Okay.
If you're trying to lose weight, please do it with intention. Please be careful.
Yeah. Yeah. Be graceful with yourself and give yourself the appropriate amount of time to accomplish that goal. It's, you know, success and progress is not perfectly linear.
Nope.
Same is true with weight loss. You're going to go up and down
yep.
over time. And it's totally fine. It's totally normal. Don't get too worked up by it. If you're working with another coach, certainly ask them. If you think that you need to lose weight, ask them for nutritional guidance, ask them for help on how to accomplish that. They should know how. If they don't, we do.
We should do an episode soon on how to gain weight. I think that's a pertinent one for just our demographic.
Yeah, we should probably do a follow-up on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to – that one's a little bit less frequent. To be honest with you, that's something I generally more rely on based on a feel that I have for their age and size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or especially if I get the opportunity to like see them in person. It can be kind of more of a dead giveaway. It's a little bit trickier to pick up on remotely.
Yeah.
And kind of like nobody's.
Sometimes you get a height and a weight statistic and you're like, whoa. Okay.
Yeah. That's. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or if somebody's got a particularly high watt per kilo, but their raw power overall really isn't low. Up there and they're not like 13. There may be a conversation to be had. But yeah, we should do some thinking and a little bit of sketching on that one before we do it. But I think that would be a really good conversation.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, now that's all I have to say on today's topic.
Good deal. Good deal. Yeah. Well, good luck on your weight loss journey. Hit us up. Happy to support. Happy to help. This is one of my love languages. So if you want to chit chat about nutrition and weight loss, I am here for it.
Absolutely. And thank you all for signing in. We love y'all.
We love you.
Be good.
See you on the next one. Yeah.